This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on March 24th. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky. And thanks to everyone who recently donated to Co-op's Spring Membership Drive. We couldn't do this without your support. Last month, the Pew Research Center issued a report titled, What the Data Says About Gun Deaths in the U.S. The following are excerpts. More Americans died of gun-related injuries in 2020 than in any other year on record, according to recently published statistics from the CDC. That included a record number of gun murders, as well as a near-record number of gun suicides. Despite the increase in such fatalities, the rate of gun deaths, a statistic that accounts for the nation's growing population, remains below the levels of earlier years. In 2020, 45,222 people died from gun-related injuries in the U.S. This was by far the most on record, representing a 14% increase from the year before, a 25% increase from 5 years earlier, and a 43% increase from a decade prior. While 2020 saw the highest total number of gun deaths in the U.S., this statistic does not take into account the nation's growing population. On a per capita basis, there were 13.6 gun deaths per 100,000 people in 2020, the highest rate since the mid-1990s. But still well below the peak of 16.3 gun deaths per 100,000 people in 1974. In 2020, 54% of all gun-related deaths in the U.S. were suicides, that is 24,292, while 43% were murders, 19,384. Nearly 8 in 10 U.S. murders in 2020 involved a firearm. That marked the highest percentage since at least 1968, the earliest year for which the CDC has online records. A little over half of all suicides in 2020 involved a gun, a percentage that has generally remained stable in recent years. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Nicole Golden, Interim Executive Director of Texas Gun Sense. Texas Gun Sense advocates for common sense, evidence-based policies to reduce gun injuries and deaths. Texas Gun Sense recognizes the right to own guns, but also believes that laws could be strengthened to include more sensible policies that would better protect the general public. We're also joined by Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. And Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of the show, is also with us. Nicole, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you. I'm great, and I'm so happy to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you here. Could you introduce yourself, tell us a little more about your own background, and then we'll move into Texas Gun Sense from there, okay?
Yeah, sure. You gave a great introduction to Texas Gun Sense, and I'll expand some more on what we're doing and the vision that we have moving forward. But to tell you a little bit about me, I've actually been involved in gun violence prevention for more than 9 years. And I was a founding leader of the Texas chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. And I got involved after the Sandy Hook school shooting, which shook me to my core. And it really changed the course of my life and the focus of my work. And I helped to grow that organization, and I grew and led the Austin group for a very long time. And so I had been working really in collaboration in many ways with Texas Gun Sense. And then in 2021, I joined their team. So gun violence prevention is really my passion and something I consider to be lifelong work.
And then you mentioned Texas Gun Sense. It was founded back in 2007, if I have that right.
Texas Gun Sense is a state-based organization with its roots here in Texas. And actually, we're unique in that way. We're really the only statewide gun violence prevention organization founded here in Texas. Mm. So, you know, we collaborate with others like the Texas chapter of Moms Demand Action, which has its roots, you know, with Everytown, which is a national group. But we are statewide and we focus on Texas. You were right. In the very early days of formation, Texas Gun Sense had some connection with gun-free schools. When it really came into creation, it was also in response to the Sandy Hook school shooting and a sense of alarm at the rate of gun violence happening here in the state, and a dedication and decision to do something about that and to advocate for policy change and to educate the community about the critical need for sensible gun laws.
Well, thanks for that background. I think the Virginia Tech shooting, some of the survivors of that were part of this too, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. Juno Woods and Frances Schenken are our co-founders. And Juno was a student at Virginia Tech when that horrible massacre occurred and lost someone close to them.
Before the show, I mentioned that Ed Scruggs had been on here previously, but I'm pretty sure that was before HB 1927. I don't know if people recognize that by that name, but maybe you could just fill us in. You're probably more knowledgeable about all that than I am. It would have been April 27th last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can speak about it a lot. I was definitely involved in the past 4 legislative sessions along with Texas Gun Sense. HB 1927, for folks who don't know, essentially allows unvetted, untrained individuals to carry loaded handguns in public in Texas without a license. And for many years prior, Texas had an established system by which individuals had to go through a certain number of hours of training to get that license to carry a gun. And it's something that most Texans from a broad range of backgrounds supported. Our lawmakers in this past legislative session pushed this through despite a strong opposition from the public, from law enforcement, from advocates, from educators, from faith leaders, students. I could go on. And this happened in the face of increasing and alarming rates of gun violence in the state. In 2020, over 4,000 Texans died due to guns. So they could have passed something like closing loopholes on background checks, which was a bill filed during the session. It didn't make it out of committee, but instead they went the absolutely wrong direction.
Yeah. And as you point out, even law enforcement expressed some serious reservations about this. I'm guessing that had to do with the safety of police officers.
That's exactly what law enforcement said. And they came out with an outpouring of opposition. Major law enforcement associations and leaders of police departments across the state felt like it endangered their officers and also endangered the public. It makes their job harder. And we know just from some research that's been done that just in general, not in terms of permitless carry specifically, but states that have weaker gun laws do show some more dangerous work for police officers. So it is a valid concern. and their testimony fell on deaf ears.
What's happened since, I guess it was last September, that depends who you're talking to, permitless carry or constitutional carry seems to be more popular as you move to the right of the political scale. That went into law last September. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on what's happened since that time? I mean, in terms of the numbers of guns and who's buying them, for example?
You know, something that's a real challenge with gun violence is it's hard to get current data. We are always looking for the most current data that we can get. For example, that statistic I gave you was the most recent that we have on total number of gun deaths in Texas was 2020, which was over 4,000, which was an increase from what it had been in the past, which had been in the 3,000s. I can just tell you anecdotally that there has been an alarming number of horrific cases of gun violence in Houston. There have been a series of road rage shootings. A number of them claimed the lives of children. There was one known case in Houston very recently, a truly horrifying story about a nine-year-old named Arlene Alvarez, who was sitting in her parents' car on Valentine's night, and they stopped at an ATM, and there was some kind of altercation not involving their family. And she was shot during that altercation, and it's believed that the person who fired the gun and unintentionally killed her did not have a license. So her family has been very outspoken, and along with some other families in Houston who are saying, you know, something has to be done for families like ours, and who have made it very clear that lawmakers, instead of protecting us, have just weakened our already weak gun laws further. So I think, you know, sadly, we're hearing some stories like that that are letting us know that we're not headed in the right direction. And some of the research that's been done just nationally has shown us that in states that have passed permitless carry laws, there has been an increase in gun deaths and homicides. So while Texas passed its recently, and we're going to have to continue to gather data and kind of look at the impact, that doesn't bode well. Our lawmakers have the moral obligation to keep us safe and protect us through safe and sensible gun laws. And they did quite the opposite this last session.
I think, you know, that this idea of keeping the community safe, it doesn't happen, particularly, you know, we see this in minority communities. We'll have this gun violence that is contrary, you know, to the articulated purpose of constitutional carry, you know, and it's just really bizarre how this message gets out without really looking at the consequences of these laws and the awful impact, as you just pointed out with the Alvarez case, that this has in minority community.
Right, absolutely. To speak to the last point that you made, there's no question that gun violence impacts communities disproportionately. And in communities of color, they're experiencing the steady daily drumbeat of gun violence in a way that other communities aren't. And it's important to note that while so often mass shootings grab our attention nationally for good reason, and that's why I got involved in the movement and something that continues to propel me forward, the majority of gun deaths are occurring in those communities by handguns. And also suicide is another extremely, you know, important piece. Two-thirds of gun deaths are suicides. So there's a lot of ways we do need to attack this problem. There's not one solution, and we absolutely need our state leaders on board. They need to, you know, close loopholes on background checks. They need to pass an extreme risk protection order. They need to prioritize domestic firearm violence laws. They need to prioritize safe gun storage. But also, we can make an impact through initiatives in the community. And that's exactly the direction that Texas Gun Sense is going. We're starting to work on developing programs that reduce firearm suicide and that reduce community violence in the areas that are most impacted.
You mentioned the lag in statistics. So, you know, given that permitless carry in Texas just went into effect last year, I guess it's no surprise that we really don't know the effect of the law very specifically. At one point, the CDC was actually maintaining some data about gun deaths. And then I thought, I don't remember when it was, I thought it was under W's presidency that they disabled that ability at the CDC, but now it looks like they're collecting it again. Do you have any insight about what's going on there?
The gun lobby has had a tremendous amount of influence and power. For many years, research on gun violence was essentially halted, but during Obama's presidency, that was lifted. So some of that research resumed and we have some catching up to do, but absolutely the CDC is doing that research. Also, there's some private research being done and there's some other resources that have emerged that are really helpful. Of course, big organizations like Everytown puts out great research, Giffords. There's also the Gun Violence Archive. There's GVpedia. Those are some important resources. But let me also mention, with regard to HB 1927, one of the successes that Texas Gun Sense had last session is that even though that was obviously a bill we fought hard, we did not want it to pass, we put all the pressure that we could, we showed up with our coalition and lawmakers pushed it through anyway, we worked with one lawmaker to put an amendment into that bill that directed the state to study the impact of the legislation over time. And we don't have that data yet, but when we do, I think it'll be really useful. And so that's a success. And that's really a great example of how this movement works, is that even when we face an uphill climb, which we do, we're always chipping away at the issue and we're always finding ways to slip in successes and continue to move forward.
Well, that is encouraging. At least we'll have some sense about the effect of the bill. You know, I've been reading about 6th Street. We just reported, I think it was last week, the Austin City Council is taking steps to study what's going on 6th Street, compare it with comparable venues around the country and see if they can make it safer, you know. The point is that here we are at the end of South by Southwest, and yet, you know, again, there was another shooting on 6th Street. Fortunately, this year, I don't know that anybody was seriously injured or nobody was killed anyway. But a year ago, that was a different story. Last summer, for example, you know, when I believe it was somebody who was actually visiting Austin, wound up dead. In all of this, it seems like the right immediately gloms onto this and says, see how dangerous Austin is. See, we need more cops. And yet nobody seems to be citing HB 1927 in all this. You know, the fact that we've got guns seemingly easier to buy than alcohol these days, and yet nobody seems to be challenging that. Is that just my perspective, or do you talk about this at the organization?
Yeah, there's so many ways I can answer that. I will tell you the first thing is that Councilmember Kathy Tovo, I think, is the one who's been doing really great work on trying to make improvements to the 6th Street area. You know, there have been studies that show that improved lighting and just beautifying public spaces is one way to reduce violence in those areas. I think that that's one way to do it. I think it's an important way. But yes, absolutely. That's why organizations like ours are here and why we're so important and need the public support, because we are here to point out the connection between these horrific events that people read about and the weak gun laws that we have in this state and the failure of our state legislature to enact sensible laws that would improve public safety, not make it worse. Another answer I'll give you is that you kind of touched on there being public demonstrations at which guns are present and some of the ways in which that has caused violence and harm to individuals at protests and at those events. You know, we do support the Second Amendment. You know, there are gun owners who are part of our organization. And at the same time, we also know that there are other sensitive places where guns don't belong, like our schools, like bars. There are just, you know, there are reasonable limitations.
Well, it's reasonable to you and me anyway.
I think when you talk to people, when you have one-on-one conversations with the public, people from abroad, spectrum of backgrounds, I think you find that most people come together to agree on the majority of these sensible approaches.
And you've touched on a lot of things that bring to mind as far as gun control and mm-hmm. gun violence are concerned. The sociological aspects of the proliferation of guns in this, the studies that have been done on why, you know, Americans feel the need to own guns in the first place, and the mythology that surrounds the safety, so to speak, of mm-hmm. society here in this country, and how that's gotten blown out of proportion. You know, that helps proliferate people's insecurities. And I will say the white supremacy culture mm-hmm. in this country about that need and all the intersections of things that that brings to bear as far as thinking about this issue. It strikes me as a big part of the problem and the root of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah. I don't know what your organization speaks to in that, or if there's some way you can kind of like talk about the idea behind what I've said and what's being done to address that, maybe sociologically or psychologically. Or...
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's a disproportionate impact on communities of color. And when we talk about gun violence, it can't be ignored. We have, you know, a really strong piece that's emerged in the movement that organizations like ours are becoming more involved in is community violence intervention programs. And we work closely, really kind of follow the lead of organizations like Community Justice Action Fund, one of our partners that's a leader in this area. And that model takes individuals who are from those communities who have experienced violence. Perhaps they've engaged in violence, and has them doing outreach maybe on the streets of that community or in hospitals or in other ways to intervene and break the cycle of violence amongst their community members. It's shown to be really positive, really promising, and it's really heartening to see that at the federal level, the administration is making an effort to allocate funding toward community violence intervention programs. We want to see that happening here at the state level too. We worked with Community Justice Action Fund to ask that state lawmakers in the third special session allocate some funding toward community violence intervention. They declined, but I think it's something that we'll absolutely continue to do.
I was wondering also, Nicole, what your take is vis-a-vis your efforts with regard to the gun litigation that's going on right now, of some of it quite successful.
What I will say, you know, we focus on the state level, so I won't claim to have been involved day to day at all in that process. However, I think what it points to is a culture shift. And I think that's one of our most important jobs in the gun violence prevention movement, is to be part of that culture shift, whether it's happening in the courts, whether it's happening in homes, whether it's happening at the state legislature, happening in our conversations, in the media. We've seen a shift toward how gun violence prevention is prioritized and talked about. And I think that is one step in the right direction.
We were talking a little before about minority communities. During the pandemic, at least hearsay would indicate that the Asian community or Asian American community has felt especially threatened, and that gun sales have increased in that regard. I suppose that's totally understandable. When people are really afraid for their lives, they're probably going to go out and buy guns. But having more guns around just seems to increase the probability that somebody's going to get shot and somebody's going to die.
To state the big message here is that, you know, if more guns made us safer, we'd be the safest country in the world. Instead, the U.S. gun homicide rate is 26 times that of other high-income countries. And here in Texas statewide, we face a significant crisis. My understanding is you're correct that, especially during the pandemic, it appeared that there was a surge in gun sales and that gun owners are becoming increasingly diverse and younger. There are more women. You know, those things concern me. You know, we're definitely living through some uncertain times. And I think the surge in gun sales and the change of the profile of who's buying is one piece of that.
In addition to people dying from someone else shooting them, there mm-hmm. is this whole topic of suicide, which you alluded yes. to a little while ago. In our introductory comments from the Pew Research Center, I was amazed at the percentage of suicidal deaths from guns. This has maybe always been the case, and like gun ownership and gun deaths in general, the number of deaths by suicide has also risen recently.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such an important piece that we always have to talk about. Firearm suicides account for 2/3 of gun deaths, and we have around 40,000 gun deaths in the U.S. every year right now. And in Texas, the most recent data tells us that suicides make up more than 60% of all firearm deaths in Texas. There are some particularly vulnerable populations. Veterans are one of them, and that's something we've been looking at closely because, you know, we know that when there's a gun in the home and when it's easily accessible, that can make the difference between life and death for someone in crisis. And our veterans are experiencing that in a high number of cases. So this is where we see a real ability to save lives and to do a lot of partnership work and do a lot of education about, you know, safe storage of guns, perhaps temporary storage of guns outside of the home during a time of crisis. Some of this is already being done, and we want to expand that work.
Can you talk a little bit about firearms and domestic violence?
I'm happy to. I'm glad you brought that up because I really wanted to talk about that. There's an absolute connection there. We follow the data that the Texas Council on Family Violence puts out. They're an incredibly helpful resource. And they put out a report that in 2020, 228 Texans were killed by a partner, an intimate partner. And of those, 67% were shot and killed. A firearm was used. We know there's a connection also between family violence and mass shootings. And we also know that while convicted domestic abusers are prohibited from purchasing and owning firearms in Texas, it's a 5-year period, there's a lack of clear protocol for the surrender of those firearms. So though they're prohibited from purchasing, they may own some. And something we've been talking about at Texas Gun Sense is to ensure that there's a clear system for relinquishment of those firearms and to make sure there's proper oversight. Because partners are incredibly at risk when there's access to a gun, and we need to protect our women and families.
Sure. And we've seen certainly through the pandemic that domestic violence has taken a serious uptick. We actually spoke early on in the pandemic with a few representatives from SAFE.
We're speaking with Nicole Golden, Interim Executive Director of Texas Gun Sense. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on March 24th. Our guest is Nicole Golden, Interim Executive Director of Texas Gun Sense. Let's pick up where we left off.
Just months into the pandemic, it was already becoming clear that domestic violence was seriously on the rise.
Absolutely. Yes. And when there's access to a gun, it really makes us incredibly concerned. It's concerning for children in the home as well. And so yet the connection cannot be ignored. And I think, you know, working with our partners like SAFE, like Texas Council on Family Violence, we really need to continue to urge lawmakers to strengthen domestic violence legislation when it comes to firearms.
Well, tell us a little more about the work of Gun Sense. I'm becoming known as a pessimist in so many things recently. Part of me is thinking, geez, since HB 1927, I mean, it sounds like the last word. Is there anything else you can do?
You know, that's a good question. Like I said earlier, we take an approach where we do everything we can. We always look for angles to take. We always look to be innovative and nimble, given the fact that we are dealing with a really challenging legislature. So we're going to continue to stay on top of whether the state fulfills its promise in that bill to track the impact. We're going to continue to work with the community on that as well to make sure that we are tracking known cases in which, you know, a person without a license was involved in gun violence. And we're also going to continue to hold our lawmakers accountable in all the ways that we can. We're going to return to the session with data and with the coalition and with survivors of gun violence to put ourselves in front of them and make it really difficult for them not to support the sensible measures that we're advocating for. But given that this legislature is so challenging, we're really looking at ways that we can affect change at the local level. And that means working with city officials and county officials and others in the community to enact, for example, more support for community violence intervention programs, maybe helping to establish offices of violence prevention throughout the state, and to educate about safe storage of firearms, which is something we've done for a long time. We want to expand that work. And also the firearm suicide prevention measures that I mentioned when it comes to our vets and other vulnerable populations. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's always hope and there's always a way to continue moving forward and to save lives. And our state lawmakers are one audience we need to continue to work with, but there's so many other ways that we can do this work.
I'm curious, it seems unnatural that you would be involved in some ways with, you said, local level stuff, but for example, mm-hmm. the Reimagining Public Safety campaign mm-hmm. that is going on and partnering with the organizations that are working to make that change here in Austin. So, mm-hmm. and adding your voice to like what a world free of gun violence and less access to guns would do towards furthering that narrative of reimagining public safety and also transformative justice as well.
Right.
So, curious.
Absolutely. No, you're speaking my language, and we're definitely working with the alliances that we've built and then also building new alliances in some of those spaces that are so important. And the Reimagining Public Safety here in Austin, part of what came out of that was the creation of the Austin Office of Violence Prevention. And we have relationships with that office. And we have a partnership with Lock Arms for Life, which is an organization that promotes safe and responsible gun storage. And through that partnership, Lock Arms for Life is working with the Office of Violence Prevention to distribute literature and on safe storage. And you might see it on some buses around town and some billboards, and also to distribute gun locks to the public. So there's a lot that can be done there. We also have relationships with the Harris County Violence Prevention Coalition that's there. So I think there's really a lot that we can do at the city level, and we have built some great partnerships so far.
I'm curious if you had to give 5 minutes advice, Nicole, to the listeners, what you would recommend that they do.
I think that's always a great question. Well, first, I have to say Texas Gun Sense at txgunsense.org for our newsletter, where you'll receive actions from us about how to use your voice. Nonprofits like ours continue to do this critically important work. We have a blog that individuals can share a personal story on or some perspective they have when it comes to gun violence. You know, we want to be in partnership with the public, and those are some things that the public can do. Other things I would say are open up the conversation in your community, you know, be that leader, be that voice. This is an issue that people sometimes don't want to touch, but we have to talk about it. Parents, other adults, ask about safe gun storage in the home where your kids might be going. Check on people in crisis. Don't be afraid to ask if they have access to a gun. You can make the difference in somebody's life. Use your voice to talk to your lawmakers at the county, city, and state level. Let them know that this issue is important to you. You know, you want them to prioritize this. Candidates who are running for office and whether they prioritize gun safety, the more they hear from people that this is important, the more that they will commit to advancing gun safety if they're elected. Those are some of the suggestions that I have. And then just learn. You know, the issue is much more multifaceted than sometimes people realize. So on our website, and to learn more, we have tons of information on there. We have a page on domestic violence. We have a page on firearm suicide. Get informed to be able to talk about this issue and the spectrum of gun violence and how it affects people on a day-to-day basis. And I would also just say, to the survivors of gun violence out there, you know, we need your voice and want your voice, and you're the reason that we do this. So we welcome you into the work. Your stories are really important.
So it sounds like listeners can go to your website.
It's txgunsense.org.
Okay. And there they can find out more information about your activities and where some of these issues stand. I noticed you have a blog on there. I was reading something you wrote that was pretty inspiring.
Thanks.
Thank you for that. And then you also mentioned that you are a nonprofit and there is a place on there where people can donate if they're so inclined, right?
Yes, absolutely. We welcome support at any level. And whether it's someone's time, talent, or donation, we welcome it all.
Great. Well, we really thank you for your time here today, Nicole. I imagine that your really busy time is during a legislative session, right? So maybe this is a time for you to reevaluate your efforts and try to figure out new strategies so that when the 2023 session opens up, pardon the analogy, but you'll have both barrels loaded, huh?
Yeah, there's a lot of those terms out there. It's hard to avoid them. I try to avoid them, but I don't always. Yes, no, you're right. Legislative session, we're very, very busy. But also, as I mentioned, we're developing other initiatives outside of the legislature. And so we're really busy exploring those and where we could have the most impact in the community too.
Great.
Yeah, keep up the good work. It's really very important, as you know, very, very important.
Thank you so much.
I'll echo Jim and Bob, I'm sure, too. Just say thank you so much for all the work that you do.
Yeah, we wish you the very best here. Again, thanks for joining us.
Oh, sure. Anytime. Thank you for reaching out.
Well, it's Friday afternoon, March 25th, and once again, we're speaking with Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How you doing this beautiful spring afternoon, Austin?
I'm doing all right. It sure is a lovely day. Thanks for having me on.
What a beautiful time to fire the cop, huh?
Right.
What's going on down there?
Yeah. So last week, the Office of Police Oversight posted a disciplinary memo from the Human Resources Department announcing basically that Chief Joe Chacon made the decision to indefinitely suspend an APD officer and kind of lay speak. That means he fired this cop on March 18th. And the reason that he fired him is pretty disturbing incidents. Basically, what happened is on August 11th of 2021, this officer, Andrew Upton, and others responded to a domestic violence call, suspected domestic violence. They got there, they're interviewing a man and a woman who are kind of involved in this altercation. And the woman complained about violence, that the male in the situation assaulted her in some way and had caused pain. And under state law, when that happens, the suspect is subject to arrest, right? It's pretty clear if you have someone complaining they were assaulted and have an injury, that's an arrest. It gives you time to figure out, do some investigative work to figure out, get both sides of the story and who is the primary aggressor and things of that nature. But it was kind of a confusing situation. The officers are kind of talking amongst one another, not really sure what to do. It's three officers. Upton is one of them. And they kind of decide to go consult their sergeant to determine what the law says and if they should get an arrest here. So two of the officers go to consult with the sergeant. Meanwhile, Officer Upton is still talking with the suspect. And this is where things get, you know, really disturbing, because what he does is he basically writes a note on his notepad to show to the suspect that says, if you go inside of your residence and shut the door, we can't arrest you. And he writes the note in a way that is out of view of his body-worn camera. He shows the note to the suspect out of view. You know, these actions clearly show that Officer Upton knew what he was doing. He was surreptitiously trying to help this suspect evade arrest. And that's exactly what happened. The suspect reads the note, turns around, walks inside of his house, shuts the door. And meanwhile, the other two officers consulting the sergeant on scene, the sergeant determines an arrest is necessary. Again, the law is pretty clear on cases like this and tells the officers, yeah, go make this arrest. And we'll kind of take the investigation from there. But obviously they can't. You know, they could make an arrest. They could have broken down the door. But this was kind of a suspected misdemeanor assault. There wasn't serious injury. And so that may have been a little bit of an extreme step to take. So the arrest didn't happen. The suspect in this alleged assault was allowed to go free directly as a result of the actions of Officer Andrew Upton, the officer who was fired as a result of this. And a really disturbing incident for a number of reasons, but the primary one is reflected in what happened after this. So as is becoming normal practice at APD, when someone is an alleged victim of domestic violence, of sexual violence, some of these different types of crimes, other types of crimes as well, but these are kind of the primary ones. APD's Victim Services Division, they're staffed with clinicians and counselors who are, you know, sort of like social workers, will reach out to the victims to say, we can connect you with resources if you feel unsafe in your home, whatever it may be. We can help you navigate the criminal justice system as a victim. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happened here. One of APD's victim services counselors reaches out to the victim and learns that the suspect in this alleged assault called the alleged victim to basically, as the counselor put it, brag about this cop helping him evade arrest. Wow. To say, the cop wrote me this note and he had my back. And the counselor basically concluded that the suspect in the alleged assault did this as a way to intimidate his victim as a power play, right? Like, don't even bother calling the cops in the future because they've got my back. And the victim told the counselor, you know, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but this is why I don't trust the police. This is why I don't want to call the police. Mm-hmm. And that right there is the big concern with this incident. APD, as we've discussed before on your show, has lost the trust of survivors of sexual assault primarily because of systemic and cultural failures within the department that kind of began to come to light around 2016, 2015. Of course, survivors of domestic violence, the Venn diagram is kind of overlapping between survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence. This distrust that survivors have in the police is something that's not unique to APD. It's something that plagues survivors across the nation, but something that APD is really telling the community that they're aware of and trying to focus on. So the actions of this officer had a direct correlation with a victim of violence's willingness to contact the police is evident of this problem. And the victim services counselor, kind of gathering this from the interview she gave to APD's Internal Affairs Division investigators as they were looking into this incident, she seemed shocked and just kind of really taken aback by this incident. To the department's credit, the counselor reported it. An investigation was undertaken and resulted in the firing of this officer. But a really disturbing incident that just came to light a couple of weeks ago.
Wow. It really is amazing when you think about it. I mean, you know, first of all, these domestic calls have got to be one of the most dangerous things that cops do. They've got to handle these properly. You know, and just thinking about the precedent that could possibly be set here if there hadn't been some action taken, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big concern about this incident among advocates. You know, they say advocates for survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence is early intervention in these hostile domestic relationships is so important, right? Because what we know about domestic violence is it's about control and power, and violence, you know, can become a part of it, but it's an escalation. Right. It may start as controlling a partner's behavior, which may escalate into violence, you know, an assault, which can escalate into murder or homicide, right?
Right.
And so the earlier the system, whether it's criminal justice or other support systems can intervene, the better, right? So this was a case where law enforcement failed to intervene directly as a result of one officer's decision to intervene on behalf of the suspect, you know, in this case. And we should be clear, these were all allegations. No one was convicted of a crime or even arrested for a crime. But the reason that arrests are useful in these cases is because it can provide a separation of the parties that gives investigators time to really get to the bottom of what's going on, to see how much of a threat each party is under, which version of the story is closer to the truth, and then kind of get from there. But that didn't happen because of the actions of this officer.
You know, and everything I pick up too about the effects of the pandemic, domestic violence is certainly up there near the top of the list in terms of consequences of what we've been through for the past 2 years.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
The other comment I would have is, man, this moved quickly.
Yeah, August 11th, 2021, and officer was fired. March 18th is when the memo was published. Quick for internal affairs and investigations at a police department, right? We've seen other investigations drag on for much longer, right? And it just kind of shows that the department can't act swiftly, relatively, when they want to. Yeah, so obviously this is a really disturbing incident, but I think it's worth pointing out that the police department as an institution kind of reacted the way you would want them to react. They got this tip essentially from the victim through the victim services counselor. It was passed on to internal affairs. They did what appears to be a thorough investigation and ended up firing the officer. And, you know, the chief in his memo announcing the decision was very clear that this was completely unacceptable behavior. And they highlighted the harm that it could bring to efforts to help survivors, which they know that they are struggling with. So I think obviously disturbing incident does not seem to be characteristic of the department overall. And the department acted decisively. The chief did, rather, in response. So, you know, it's kind of an incident where very disturbing case, but somewhat encouraging response from the police department.
And I'll treat this as a rhetorical question, but you just got to wonder, what was that guy thinking?
Yeah, completely agree. Yeah. There's some other details in the memo that kind of make you wonder what was going through this guy's head. But yeah.
I understand you're working on another story regarding the Austin Community Court. Apparently they're relocating.
Yeah, it's the downtown Austin Community Court, which I just point out because it's an important part of the story here. This is a specialty court that deals specifically in Class C misdemeanors. First, it was just kind of downtown. It has been expanded since then to include parts of, you know, Central East Austin and parts of West Campus. And they primarily serve people experiencing homelessness through two functions. First is the adjudication of Class C misdemeanor citations, which can be tickets that result in fines. A lot of the public camping and panhandling type offenses, other city ordinance violations would go through this court. But they also have a case management side where they offer services to people experiencing homelessness. And they've become a really trusted, really important partner in the kind of broader Austin, Travis County community's effort to help in homelessness through their case management division and their day services, stuff that they offer. And so for most of the court's life, they were located near APD downtown on 6th Street, right there near I-35. But that kind of become a really derelict building. Most of the city's offices have moved out of there or are on their way out. And since then, they've been going to temporary location. Throughout the pandemic, they were operating at the Terrazas Branch Library in East Austin that was closed to the public when, you know, the libraries were closed. And then they moved last year to the One Texas Center, which is a city-owned facility off of Riverside and the Barton Springs Road area.
Right.
And they've been there for a while, but they need a permanent home that most of city council and the court says needs to be downtown. Obviously, that's in the name, but more importantly, most of the population that they serve, whether it's through the court function or the case management, is coming from downtown. In January, city staff looking at locations recommended what is called the municipal building. It's Austin's old city hall on West 8th Street as kind of the ideal location. It's a city-owned facility, got the necessary square footage, proximity to transit and other homeless services located downtown, but it needs a lot of renovation to the tune of about $27 million worth. Yeah, it's a big price tag, but it's something that most of that cost, about $22 million of that cost, is going to need to occur no matter how the facility is used, whether it's by the court or cultural nonprofit use, whatever it is. You know, there's asbestos, it's an older building, the plumbing and electrical need to be completely redone. So it's really extensive work. Staff recommended this site. They need council to approve the funding. Council has punted on it, I think, four times now, because there was a lot of opposition from downtown interests, the Downtown Austin Neighborhood Association, the Downtown Austin Alliance have opposed the move to this location. They say it's too far from services. It's up a hill that they say would be difficult for people needing a more accessible location. They say that the city promised this site for cultural usage, like nonprofit music and arts usage, which is not really true. What council did in May of 2020 was direct staff to look at city-owned facilities for this kind of cultural use, the municipal building being one of those facilities, but it was in no way promised for this type of use. But at any rate, there's people living in a condominium development that's really close that are opposing it for a lot of the same reasons you might suspect. They kind of view the court moving in as a public health and a public safety threat because of the population that it would be serving, things of that nature. So yeah, council again punted this decision at their meeting last week to a kind of undetermined date. And they asked staff to take a closer look at other locations, if the court needs to change its service model, all of these other kind of bigger questions that are going to delay permanent relocation of this service, which is, you know, really important for the community's effort at ending homelessness, right? And so it's been frustrating for the staff, for people who utilize services at the court, that we don't really have an end to this story in mind. We're kind of having to see where staff and council goes.
I think the last point you were making there is probably the most important one. You know, as the city is desperately trying to do something about the homelessness here, I think that the public is going to have to accept a few things. You know, I think about, for example, that hotel up in District 6. And I think we're talking about something very similar here.
They're different in that the hotel would be housing, right? Apartments for people exiting homelessness. This is services, right? So this is people wanting to improve their lives, wanting to get into housing, what job assistance, whatever it may be, walking into a facility to talk with a case manager. But yeah, you're absolutely right that it's a version of the same opposition we see time and time again when it comes to opening a new shelter or housing or services for homeless. If it's going into a neighborhood near where people live, there are inevitably going to be people opposed to that. And some of that is rooted in legitimate concern based on maybe an unrealistic vision of what is going to happen, right? I think when people who oppose these type of facilities in their neighborhood, what they envision is the Arch downtown, right? The Austin Resource Center for the Homeless, where you've got people, you know, lining up for services every day, which doesn't happen as much anymore now that they've changed their model. But that's kind of the vision that people have with these type of facilities. But that's not what would happen, right? I was at the One Texas Center a couple of weeks ago, and that's not the scene there at all. It's an office building. You have people coming in and out. You wouldn't know who's going there for their job, who's going there for services, who's going there for some other reason. And with the housing, there were apartments, right? You know, we've had, the city had been calling them pro lodges. They were pandemic era protective lodging for people experiencing homelessness. Those were existing for months, and you wouldn't know that they were housing people experiencing homelessness unless you were kind of in the know, because it's just housing, right? It's just people living there, right? So I think there's a kind of fundamental misconception about what these facilities will actually look like on the ground. And it's difficult to overcome those fears, because you have to actually make the thing happen and show people that it won't be that. But you have to overcome their fears before that can happen. So it's a challenging situation the city's in.
Absolutely. Well, as always, we're so grateful for your coverage of civic events and local happenings here. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate it.
That's all from us this evening. Stay safe, everyone, and stay tuned for Co-op's local music mix next on the HD3 channel and on coop.org.